has any reactions? All reactions are reactivity? What's the difference between reacting to something and responding to something? These are the questions I'd like to explore this afternoon. Let's start with the idea simply of reaction. Now, I'm going to present this in the framework of the early Buddhist understanding of how experience happens. Not how experience is. I don't want to make any sort of claims that this is the nature of our reality. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in, and I think this is what the Buddha was interested in, was providing us with useful frameworks of practice, of thinking, to help us get a better handle on our lives and thereby showing us a way in which we can live more fully, less reactively, less driven by instinct and habit and conditioning, and thereby learning to live more autonomously, hopefully more wisely, more caringly. There's a very early text in the Sanyutta Nikaya. These are the Gesammelte Lehrräder von des Buddhas, the Sanyutta Nikaya. And in there you will find lots of tiny little texts. There is some argument among scholars that this might actually be the earliest of the Nikayas, the bodies or the collections of discourses that the Buddha gave. The Sanyutta Nikaya has a certain structure to it, which is not really the case with the other collections. Most of the other collections have to do with how long the text is, the longer discourses, the middle-length discourses, or simply a collection of all of the lists, everything that can be numbered as a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or a 4 or a 5. So purely functional, descriptive ways of organizing the Buddha's teaching, but otherwise with very little structure or continuity within the body of those collections themselves. The Sanyutta, by contrast, seems to have been developed in a more systematic way. Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's the translator into English of these texts, argues that the Sanyutta is probably the collection that the early community at the Buddha's time, very possibly, began to use to organize his ideas. I'm really just saying that to give what I'm going to say now a little bit more authority. But it's, I think, nonetheless important, as I mentioned yesterday, make use of the scholarly, historical, critical examination of Buddhist texts, because it does give us some kind of framework to assess whether a teaching or a doctrine is of an earlier or possibly of a later period. I think that's important because in my understanding, the Dharma the Buddha taught evolved and developed over the following centuries into an increasingly orthodox set of doctrines and dogmas and so forth and so on. But my feeling is that the earlier strata, the earlier layers that we can detect more and more are less, as it were, committed to an orthodox belief system. They seem to be much more pragmatic and experientially based, I would argue. But anyway, leave that to one side. The text that I'm interested in is one that offers an account of what are called the five khanda, the five bundles or aggregates, as they're usually translated. But basically, these are five features of human experience that the Buddha found helpful to use as a framework for this practice. In other words, for me, the five aggregates are not a sort of proto-scientific description of the mind or the human being, but should be seen more as an operational frame. They're a framework for doing something that help optimize the accomplishment of particular tasks. And since I present the Dharma as the recognition, performance, and accomplishment of four tasks, then it makes more sense to think of the five aggregates, the four mindfulnesses, all of these lists of doctrines as effectively operating frames, frameworks within which we can then more effectively accomplish these tasks. So the framework of the five aggregates is very fundamental. For those of you who are not familiar with or might have forgotten, the five aggregates are rupa, which means matter or form. Sometimes it just refers to the body, but actually in most cases it refers to the physical world in its totality. In other words, what we see and smell and taste and touch, these are part of the rupa khanda, of the bundle of physicality, we might say. That includes one's body, obviously, but it has just as much to do with the phenomenal world of sense impressions as well. The second is vedana, which we can loosely translate as feeling, although people now prefer something like tonalitet or feeling tone. I'll say more about this in a minute. The third one is sanya, translated in many different ways, but I prefer to simply use wahrnehmung, perception. It's how basically the world makes sense to us, whether that's through concepts or language, or whether it's just simply through the ways in which our minds have been formed through our education, our culture, that renders the world meaningful. That's sanya, perception. Literally, it means the knowing that holds things together. Together knowing, sanya. In other words, what makes sense, coherence in life. The fourth is called sankhara, translated again in many different ways. I would use the English word inclination. It's that which moves us to respond, react in a particular way to a situation at hand. It's usually translated as volitional formations. I can't think of a worse way to translate it. I just don't know what that means, volitional formations, but somehow it's become normative in English translations. It's inclinations, impulses, tendencies, patterns of habitual behavior, all of those are included there. And finally, number five is vijnana, which is usually translated as consciousness, which I think is fairly okay, but you could argue that it means simply cognition, to know something, actually. So, in the text in the Samyutta, the Buddha asks, what gives rise to feeling? What gives rise to sanya? What gives rise to perception? What gives rise to inclination? Three questions. What gives rise to feeling? What gives rise to perception? What gives rise to inclination? And to each question, he gives the same answer. He says, what gives rise to feeling, perception, and inclination is passa, contact, impact, connection. And that contact refers to the contact of the physical world, what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, as well as what bubbles up from within ourselves, in our minds, that when the organism comes into contact with any object, external or internal, that automatically triggers three things. We feel a certain way, the world or the object makes sense in a certain way, and we are predisposed to react to it in a certain way. Okay? So, let's say, for example, I walk into this room and I behold all of you, then that is the contact of this room and what I can see outside the windows. That impacts me through my eyes and my ears, my nose too. Might smell a certain way. It's got a certain musty, smelly feel to it. I doubt it tastes of anything, but it also would have a physical sense. It might feel warm or cold in the room. So when I come into a room, I'm impacted through my physical senses with a whole bunch of data. And that is translated very rapidly. We now know from neuroscience it actually takes about half a second before the data that has impacted the senses then is processed through the brain and appears in consciousness. Very, very fast. But still there is a delay that can be measured. So coming into this space, I feel a certain way. Now that could be a feeling of, oh my God, I've got to give a talk. I'm not feeling great about this. These people know more about it than I do probably. Or contrary, oh, I know everything. This is going to be fun. This is going to be a breeze. But I feel it. That actually feels a certain way. I feel good about myself. I feel uncomfortable about myself. This vedana, this feeling, is actually a very important dimension of this practice. We might come back to it again. But nonetheless, I think we can at least get a rough idea of what it means, that experience is always characterized by feeling a certain way. It also makes sense to me. When I come into the room, I'm not confronted with lots of shapes and colors, let's say. I'm confronted with windows and lampshades and projectors and individual people, some of whom I recognize, some of whom I don't. It happens automatically. That is sanya. It makes sense. It's meaningful. It might immediately generate a commentary. I talk to myself about it. But the point is, I come into this room and I already encounter a world, a situation that bears meaning. That's the point. It means something. It's not just neutral data, but it is meaningful. People, spatial situation, temporal situation, it all makes sense. I might, of course, be getting it wrong, but it still makes sense. And thirdly, I find myself, as in any situation, somehow primed as soon as I've felt, not even as soon as, but simultaneously with feeling, perceiving, I then find myself in a realm of possible action. This is where ethics comes in. And this is called sankhara. I find myself predisposed to react to the situation, to respond to the situation. In other words, the world is always somehow calling forth a response. We are not passive, neutral objects in the world. We are moral agents, always. That is what it means to be human. I will be faced with choices in this room. I'm faced, very obviously, in my case, with a task. I've got to give a talk. And so my whole experience is somehow saturated with this expectation of doing something. And there, I think, we can begin to talk about reactions. Because what I feel, what I perceive, in other words, how the situation is intelligible to me, these are just givens. I can't do anything about that. That's just what happens. But I'm immediately called upon or find myself drawn to engage with the situation in a certain way. And again, I notice that my reactions to the situation are not just the things I consciously select and decide to do, but automatically I feel myself moved in a certain way. At the most basic level, as we saw this morning, I'm attracted or I'm repelled. I'm drawn to the situation or I find myself in a defensive stance. I don't like it so much. I feel uncomfortable. That's often the case when you have to go give a talk, particularly to a large audience of people you don't know. I generally find there's a certain reaction of aversion. I don't feel comfortable here. I don't feel totally safe. My instinct is basically to walk out of the room. But I can't do that because I'm a responsible person, all that kind of stuff. And I'll upset the organizer of the Stiftung and so on. So I have to override that unpleasant feeling, override that instinct to go out of the room, override my sense that this is a dangerous place that I perceive, and then I engage in a task. So reactions, therefore, are totally natural. There's nothing wrong with how we react. Even if I sometimes enter a situation or see a person or read a text and immediately there rises up in my mind anger or rage or dislike, that's an entirely natural process. There's nothing wrong with that. It wasn't something that I have consciously intended to do as a moral agent. This is simply what the passa, the contact, triggers. Absolutely, it's not yet at a point where we can talk of ethics or morality. And I think this is a really kind of important point in the ethical question. In other words, just because I feel like, let's say, just because I want to shout at somebody and tell them how stupid they are, that doesn't qualify as a moral act unless I somehow deliberately decide to do that. If it's just arising up in my mind, it is outside of my volition. it's outside of my control. Another reason I don't like the translation, volitional formation. There often is no volition. It's just what I feel like doing, spontaneously. And, of course, sometimes I go ahead and just follow the reaction. I can't, either it's too strong, or either I agree with it so much that it seems the right thing to do. But I'm largely driven by that reaction. So I think we can all see quite easily feelings, perceptions, reactions. And the reactions that are rising up in that first instance are pre-ethical or pre-moral. There's nothing right or wrong going on here in any moral sense. And the implication of that is there's nothing you need to feel guilty about. Religions are often in the business of making us feel somehow personally responsible for our feelings and our thoughts and our impulses, which have arisen quite naturally out of the circumstances of our life, our past, our culture, our history, and so on. And this, I think, is something we work with very much in the practice of mindfulness, the practice of vipassana, of awareness, is that we learn just to, as the lady was saying this morning, just to be a witness to all of that, just to observe these things. And the stiller and the more focused and the clearer the mind becomes, the more that we can observe these processes at their inception. We can catch these things closer to their source. The problem very often in our world and in our lives is that these impulses and reactions occur so quickly, and they can be so overwhelming, and we can be so convinced that they're right, that we just go with them, and it's often several minutes later that we register what we've been doing. It's as though we've been driven by these forces, and it takes a while for us to even realize what we've been caught up. Meditation gives us a very good opportunity to see this. And what is often slightly alarming when we sit in meditation and just watch the breath, for example, and remain present, is that it's so frequent that we find ourselves distracted, and not even consciously distracted. We actually just get washed away, and then at a certain point we remember, oh, I'm meditating. Ah, right. What did he say? The breath, right. Back to breath. You've probably had this experience many times. The meditation gives us a kind of a magnifying glass to observe these processes much more, with much greater granularity, with much greater precision, with much greater stability. So when does a reaction become reactivity? Reactivity has certain characteristics. One of the characteristics is that it is repetitive. It's not just a stray thought or emotion that comes up and then goes away, but it's a thought or an emotion that very quickly becomes a cycle. It goes round and round and round. We keep repeating certain words in our mind. You know, they don't like me. They don't like me. They don't like me. And this becomes a sort of reinforcing loop. When you see somebody looking a little bit dour They're not smiling at you. They don't like me. They don't like me. I know now they're looking at me in a negative way. And the more that this persists, the worse it gets. That's an example of reactivity. Circularity. This is how Gautama describes it in his definition in the first discourse. And that, frankly, is what reincarnation means. Rebirth. The stopping of reactivity is the stopping of circularity. Keeping on repeating, doing the same things again and again and again and again. Our life doesn't flourish. It remains trapped in a self-reinforcing cycle of habits, repetitive phrases, fueled emotions, and so on. That is reactivity. The other way we might look at reactivity is metaphorically, reactivity is compared to fire. In the Buddha's third discourse, which is called the Fire Sermon, this is very explicit, where he says the world is burning. It's burning with what? Burning with greed, burning with hatred, burning with confusion. In other words, reactivity heats us up. Reactivity is like fire. It flares up. It's a bit like a match against a matchbox. You strike it and it flares up. The human organism is like a match. It strikes the matchbox of the world, the environment. And very often, something then flares up. Dislike, or attraction, or confusion, or egoism, or pride, whatever it might be, it flares up and then gets caught up in cyclical patterns of repetition. Reactivity is also described metaphorically as being barren, trockenheit, aridity in English, aridität, can you say that? Yeah. In other words, once we're caught up in this reactivity, nothing grows. There's no water to nourish anything. It's a very dry, flammable, and importantly, a situation in which we're kind of no longer able to really flourish in a positive way. We're just caught up in this cycle of repetition, this heating up, this drying up, and it becomes very often extremely intense. And if you follow through some of these reactive patterns, it could become pathological, particularly in terms of your mental health. You might become really quite neurotic about something. Neuroses, again, are often characterized in this way. They're repetitive, they're somehow out of our control, they heat us up, and we have very little capacity to do much about it, particularly once they've developed a certain force within us. Reactivity is also symbolized by the figure of Mara. I mentioned that this morning. I don't have time to go into detail on that today. If you're interested, I wrote a book about this called Living with the Devil. I think it exists in German, Mit dem Börsenleben. That's basically a study of reactivity, but at the time I wrote the book, I wasn't using the word reactivity, so it's not mentioned. But it's effectively what that book is all about. How do we live with this stuff? And as I said, I think yesterday, reactivity is not just a temporary problem that humans have. It is rooted deep in our neurobiology. It goes back to the amoeba in the primeval swamp being drawn towards what it needs and being repelled by what it fears. it's in the limbic system of the brain, apparently, that all of these patterns are locked, rooted. So the idea of one day completely getting rid of it is a little unrealistic. The point is to learn how to live with it, learn how to manage our inner lives such that we're no longer endlessly frustrated and overwhelmed and depressed by this out-of-control mind that takes over. In terms of thinking of Mara, the demonic, and Mara, the word, means the killer. It's connected to the Sanskrit root for death. Mara is a kind of death. Reactivity is a kind of inner death. It's like aridity. Nothing is living. And Mara is also called in the Pali texts Antaka. Antaka means the one who imposes limits. So there's something about reactivity that keeps us stuck within certain boundaries and horizons. There's no way, once we're in that boundary, to somehow get out of it. It traps us. It narrows our perspective. It confines us within a particular story, a particular emotion, that the more it persists, the more difficult it is to do anything about it. So that is reactivity. Now, nirvana is defined in many of the early texts as simply adosa, aloba, amoha, the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of confusion. And I'm taking that as my working definition of nirvana. It's a definition that occurs many times, again, particularly in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it is a very simple and I think a very practical definition of a term that otherwise has become very mystified. Nirvana. We'll never attain nirvana. Nirvana is this great enlightenment, this great goal of the Buddhists, and so forth and so on. But actually, it's defined in a very simple way. And as we saw yesterday in my talk, I gave the story of the dialogue between Gautama and Sivaka. And Gautama asks Sivaka, "And do you know when you are not reactive?" In other words, do you know when there is no greed, no hatred, no delusion in you? And Sivaka says yes. In other words, it's a condition that is clearly visible, sanditiko, immediate, akaliko, inviting, ehipasiko, and so on. So nibbana is not some exotic attainment long, far away from where we are now. Nibbana is already here and now. It's waiting. It's clearly visible. If only we could see it. That's the problem. Because the Buddha also describes it as dudaso, difficult to see. So it's clearly visible, but hard to see. And that paradox, I think, is an important one to acknowledge. Again, many mystics in different traditions seem to often say things like this. When I finally understood this X, I realized I'd known it all along. It's a weird kind of wake up. It's sometimes very difficult to see the things that are closest to us. We find this in St. Augustine, the church father. He says that God is even closer to me than my sense of I, my sense of being me. God is actually closer to me than that sense of my own self. Again, it sounds strange, sounds a bit mystical. And I'm not at all sure what he means by God. But nonetheless, the idea is similar. This non-reactive nibbanic state is actually very close to hand, already potential, if not actual, in each moment. But Buddhism has somehow lost sight of that and turned nirvana into something rather remote and difficult to experience. Someone told me of a podcast recently by Robert Wright, who was interviewing a well-known Buddhist figure in America, a monk. And he asked the monk, "Have you experienced nirvana?" And the monk couldn't stop laughing at the stupidity of the question. Now, I find that rather sad, frankly. And it shows the extent to which religions often function as structures of alienation. In other words, they alienate the practitioners from the highest goals and values of the tradition. This is an insight we find in Ludwig Feuerbach, particularly Das Wesen des Christentums, where he talks of Christianity as basically a system of alienation. And Marx and Engels took their ideas of religion from Feuerbach. Now, Feuerbach didn't really understand anything about Buddhism, but his analysis of religion as a system of alienation is just as applicable to Buddhism as anything else. Another reason to let go of the religion called Buddhism. The religion called Buddhism, to my mind, can get in the way of practicing the Dharma because it puts everything at such a remove very often. It alienates us from what we value, and those values are then projected onto those in authority. In other words, the priests, the lamas, the roshis, they're enlightened, and the extent that they are enlightened, to that same degree, I am deluded. That's how religions exert their authority over people and very often ally themselves with repressive political forces. We're going down a track here I don't need to go down. But it's worth flagging, I believe. To me, the whole introduction and the whole use and application of mindfulness in the secular world is probably, in my lifetime, what has opened the door to our recovering the Dharma of Gautama. Because it's been shown to work in totally non-Buddhist situations. It's a human birthright, frankly. So, where was I? I got lost. Yes, nirvana. So, the wonder of the internet, one of the wonders of the internet, is that the whole of the Pali Canon is now online. And not only that, there's one site in particular called suttacentral.net. Has anyone visited suttacentral.net? Yes? Now, suttacentral.net is one of the great contributions to human culture today. And it not only has the entire Pali Canon in Pali, it now has a complete new translation of all of the texts in a consistent vocabulary by Bhikkhu Sujato, who's an Australian monk, who spent 2 years retranslating the whole thing. You know, I did it in an hermitage in Taipei somewhere, Taiwan. And We now, and it's all open source. There's no copyright. It's all freely available. So you can now punch any sentence in Sujata's translation or in the Pali original, and you'll immediately get the translation. You double-click on a word, you automatically get to the Pali dictionary. It's incredible. And they're also now including more and more translations in non-English languages. There's lots in German now up there. And it's a work in progress. It's endlessly expanding. Now, with a resource like that, you can get answers to questions very quickly. So what I did once is I took the definition of Nibbana, absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of confusion, in the Pali, put it into the search engine, and then about 2 nanoseconds later, I knew every instance in the Pali canon where this phrase appeared. And this allowed me to understand that the same definition of Nibbana is also the definition of 3 other key terms. And what are those 3 other key terms? One of them is amata, usually translated as the deathless. It literally means non-death, not dying or not dead, the deathless. Again, a word that's given all kinds of mystical associations in Buddhism, but basically it means a condition where Mara is not operative, a non-reactive space. And that implies a space in which one can flourish. It's the opposite of death. The next term that is defined in the same way is asankata, translated as the unconditioned. Again, a very popular expression amongst aspiring Buddhist mystics to experience the unconditioned. And again, this is defined in exactly the same way: absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of delusion. And what this shows, I think, very clearly is that the unconditioned does not mean some unconditioned state that is no longer in any way to do with the conditioned world. The unconditioned. It simply means that it's possible at any moment to not be conditioned by greed, by hatred, by confusion. The unconditioned is effectively being used as a verb rather than a noun. It's not a thing, even a mystical cosmic thing. It's simply the recognition that it's possible to respond to life unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion. In other words, it's a synonym for nirvana, non-reactivity, deathless, and unconditioned. And the third term that is defined in exactly the same way is the word parinya. Now, parinya means to fully understand. And parinya is the term the Buddha uses for the first task. Right, the first task is to embrace life, or dukkha. Embrace it. Fully understand it. Parinya. That's what parinya means. To fully understand, to embrace. And that too is defined as absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of confusion. In other words, this is a knowing, an understanding that is non-reactive. So when you practice the first task, you embrace the world, including yourself and others, in a way that's not inflected by your greed and your hatred and your confusion. And this is this really blew my mind when I read this. Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his translation, says, oh, this is very puzzling. I don't think it is. I think it's actually an incredible confirmation of this task-based model. Because what it shows is that although we can think of four tasks, one after the other, embrace life, let go of reactivity, see the stopping of reactivity, and actualize a path, in fact, that's really more than anything a didactic model. It's a useful way to parse this process in order to get greater clarity on the different facets of this practice. But in actual life, it goes too fast. Actual life requires us to engage in a fourfold task. You can think of it as four tasks. You can also think of this as one single task. And if you think about it, that kind of has to be the case. Embracing dukkha, the first task, must necessarily include mindfulness, for example, a degree of concentration, an effort, an intention, a view, all of which are in the fourth task, the Eightfold Path. Embracing dukkha, we can now see, is also got to do with nirvana itself. If this embracing is a non-reactive embrace, then it's already implying the presence of a non-reactive mind. And seeing the non-reactive mind is the third task. It's also, in a sense, a letting go of reactivity. And I feel also we could bring in here that it is thereby open to metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. It's open to love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. These are the qualities that are implied in this practice of embracing life. It's not just a cold, clinical, cognitive recognition of something. It's a warm-hearted embrace of the situation we're in, of oneself and of others. And this is, I think, important. The practices of loving-kindness and compassion are, I feel, already there in the very first task. They're already implied. They're already part and parcel of what an embrace would mean. And that's one of the reasons I like in English using the word embrace, to give that emotional dimension some space. So if we come back to this idea of reactivity, reactivity is central to the process of the four tasks. In the first task, we're called upon to embrace the reactivity, in other words, to accept it as it is, to notice that it's just a naturalistic process that rises up when the conditions occur for it to do so. It's also something that we can let go of. In other words, we are free not to follow its agenda or story. We can say, oh, that's interesting. Here it goes again. I can see it. It's okay. It's not pleasant. I notice it's not pleasant, but there it is. And if I leave it alone, it will gradually fade away of its own accord. You don't actually have to do anything. You just have to not get caught up in it. Since these reactive patterns are impermanent, you leave them alone and they will come to a stop by themselves. That doesn't mean that they won't come back again very quickly, but you don't need to build up a kind of a firestorm unnecessarily. Just let it go. And so reactivity is there in terms of what you let go of, in terms of what you embrace, what you let go of, and also the absence of reactivity is what you dwell upon when the mind comes to a rest, when the mind becomes still. You taste and savor and honor the capacity to be non-reactive. And you feel that through the body, not just in the mind. It's a deep stilling of emotions and body. Or at least it is a kind of centered point of awareness that remains unflustered and unaffected by whatever storm is going on around you. And the first discourse concludes, no, it doesn't quite, but yeah, it concludes pretty much, with a statement by one of the five monks who heard the discourse. His name was Kondanya. And when Kondanya had heard this teaching on the four tasks, I think, rather than the four truths, to be honest, he said, whatever arises is something that ceases. Whatever arises is something that ceases. And this is his insight that led to the opening of the Dhamma eye. His Dhamma eye, the eye that sees the Dhamma, was open at that point on hearing this discourse. And what he understood is whatever arises, samudaya, and what arises is reactivity, craving, however we translate that, is something that ceases. Nirodha, which is nibbana, which is the stopping. And so the key insight that this man arrived at was that the Dhamma, the teaching, the practice, is centered around the noticing of the arising of reactivity, letting go of that which has arisen, and observing what has arisen to come to a stop. That's the key process. And that's the key process, whether it be in a religious setting of a monk or a nun, in a meditation retreat, in a forest, or whether it's, as I said yesterday, a housewife from Heidelberg dealing with her anxiety attacks. It's exactly the same process. I'm not saying that, you know, these are equivalent experiences. Obviously, they're not. But the core logic, the core dynamic of this practice operates in exactly the same way. 3 o'clock. I hope that's been helpful. I'm not going to now say any questions. I want us now to go back to the silence, go back to our meditation, and at the end of the afternoon, around 5:30 probably, we'll open this up for a discussion. And we can explore this in whatever ways we will. But rather than just begin that now, I'd like us to try and absorb whatever we've picked up from this talk that we think to be helpful, or even those things that we're saying, hey, that, I don't agree with that. You must be wrong on that point. Think about that too. And so when we come back, when we open this discussion at the end of this afternoon, you know, we'll have maybe digested some of these things. We'll be able to speak to them with perhaps greater clarity.